May it please the court. My name is Doyle Baker. I'm a deputy district attorney from Colorado Springs. Bar registration is 22277. I represent the people in this appeal. I hope to discuss as many of Judge Kane's reasons for granting a new trial as possible in a lot of time, beginning with his conclusion that Mr. Kennedy received ineffective assistance from his trial counsel. Mr. Kennedy's attorney, Kenneth Dresner, presented a defense that was based on an informed choice, a choice that he made as a matter of strategy. It was a defense that was ultimately unsuccessful, but that doesn't mean that Mr. Dresner was ineffective. Strategic choices such as he made in this case are, as the Strickland standard informs, entitled to heavy deference. And here, Mr. Dresner made a decision to pursue a defense that, as he described it, created reasonable doubt in numerous ways. And he based that on a series of, or a mock trial that he presented to two different juries, and the feedback that he received from those jurors and the psychologist that helped him put that together. And what he got from that was that, in terms of the defense to pursue, none of the jurors that were convinced in that mock trial that the defendant was not guilty had mentioned the alternate suspect defense or a specific alternate suspect. And based on that, among other things, Mr. Dresner made his choice to forego a specific defense that at this 35C hearing, defense counsel indicated he should have pursued. The problem with that defense was that, number one, the mock jurors weren't buying the theory that this was a specific alternate suspects, Stroud and Corkins and their associates, that committed this crime. Certainly Mr. Stroud had a motive, as did Ms. Corkins, but they were in prison, or in jail rather, at the time. They couldn't actually have committed the murders. And even if they were involved, Mr. Kennedy would not be necessarily eliminated as a suspect. And there was certainly other evidence pointing to his participation in these murders.
Also, do you agree that the case was largely circumstantial? I mean, there was no direct eyewitness to the actual killings, correct?
There was a lot of circumstantial evidence. Okay. Your Honor.
And you know, given that it was largely a circumstantial case, this is not just about what happened at trial, but also about information that came to light after the trial. And I'd like you to address the issue of the bullet composition evidence. The FBI ended up retracting, you know, their earlier assertions that they could actually match.
Absolutely. Well, the problem with the bullet composition evidence, or the lead composition evidence, is that there was no evidence on that issue presented at the 35C hearing. What you have in the record is a pleading from the defendant saying this is a problem, and a letter that was submitted from someone at the FBI to our office.
Counsel, is it your position that that letter was not in evidence and could not be considered by the court?
That's right, Your Honor. I don't think that it was in evidence. And to give you a comparable circumstance, if we came into trial, or into court rather, with a complaint and information and a report, written report from the arresting officer attached, and we presented it to the judge and said, here, we've met our burden, we could not win. And the same thing should happen in this instance. We're talking, obviously, about a different burden. We're talking about a different source of the burden. In this case, the rule presents the defendant with the burden and the case law of presenting his, or proving his case beyond, or by a preponderance. But he still has to present some sort of evidence. What the pleading and the letter get you are the hearing. And the judge, when he's looking at this and evaluating it initially, looks at all of the evidence in the light most favorable to the defendant and decides, do I give him a hearing or don't I?
Excuse me, Mr. Baker, I understand your position. And I'd actually like to go back to the ineffective assistance claim, but I want to make sure that Judge Fox gets her concerns about this issue addressed.
Just one more question, then we can move on to that. It's my understanding that we've got a trial court ruling. The trial court actually did make a ruling with regard to the FBI information. And then we've got an incomplete or incomprehensible transcript. So, I mean, how are we to say that this information was or wasn't in front of the trial court? I mean, we have to assume that it was in front of the trial court because the trial court addressed it. And isn't it the prosecution's burden to bring forward, you know, those transcripts to show us what happened?
What we're missing from the record is defense counsel's statements. If you read that transcript, what you see is that our prosecutor who was at the hearing expressed a concern about, Judge, where are we going with this? Do we need to be prepared at the 35C hearing to present evidence on this lead bullet composition issue? Then you have some statements from defense counsel that weren't picked up, but then you have Judge Kane saying, no, you don't need to be concerned with that. It's not going to be an issue. And you have the minute order from Judge Kane saying that this has been withdrawn as an issue. And on top of that, you have the 35C hearing itself, where none of this is mentioned. I think that defense counsel mentioned it in passing in their closing argument. But the fact is, we took Judge Kane at his word. He told us, you don't need to be worried about this. It's not going to be an issue. And then defense didn't present any evidence on that issue, and we responded in kind. We didn't.
And there was a subsequent hearing in between the one that you're referencing and the 35C, and again, there was no transcript produced for that hearing. So we don't know whether it touched on the issue of the FBI evidence or not. I mean, we don't know one way or the other.
Well, again, I mean, what we know from what Judge Kane said. And, you know, ultimately, I think at the end of the day, his ruling has to be what controls the way the hearing goes. And he said it's not going to be something you need to rebut. Based on that, and based on the complete lack of evidence, to prevail in a 35C, you've got to win by or persuade the court by a preponderance of the evidence. And there just was nothing presented at the hearing. What we have at most is this letter, which is hearsay, that was filed as part of the pleadings. But it may be enough to get him the hearing. It shouldn't be enough to get him relief on that issue.
I'd like to address the ineffective assistance of counsel finding. You have certainly shown that there was some strategy that was followed by Mr. Dresner. And the trial court, in its ruling, seemed to indicate that the presumption of effective assistance and following an effective strategy had been overcome. And I didn't see in your brief how we're supposed to treat that. As I understand it, that's a finding of fact which we're supposed to give deference to if there's evidence in the record to support it. Would you agree with that standard of review?
Well, let me think about this a minute, Your Honor. It's a mixed question of law and fact. And I think when we're talking facts, we're talking about what Mr. Dresner did. I think a conclusion that his strategic choice was insufficient to meet the standard would be a legal conclusion. And the troubling thing about both Judge Kane's ruling and the expert report that was filed by the defense on the ineffective assistance claim is that neither one of those even acknowledges that Mr. Dresner did anything. It's as if the mock trial never occurred. And normally when you're talking...
Whether there was a mock trial or not, apparently there was some strategy that was followed. The court seems to have, in some sense, acknowledged that there was a strategy. It doesn't really talk about it in the trial court's order, but concludes nevertheless that counsel was ineffective. Aren't we supposed to give any deference to that finding?
I think it's a legal conclusion, Your Honor.
Well, your brief is full of facts And you're essentially asking us to reweigh the facts and conclude that he was not, that he was effective. That's the concern that I have about the position that you're taking on the ineffective assistance claim.
Well,
help me with that.
Sure. The test for ineffective assistance of counsel, I think, is somewhat hard to apply in terms of appellate review because
well, it's easy if the court finds that he was effective, right? But this is the opposite. It makes it a little harder for us.
And usually when you're talking about giving something deference, you're not talking about deference in a legal conclusion. You're talking about deference to a fact finder who finds a witness more credible than another witness, or deference on a discretionary ruling that a judge makes. But here, I think that the deference is built into the legal test. And, Judge Cain, he may give lip service, I guess, to this, but he doesn't really analyze it. He doesn't explain how this can be that, in fact, Mr. Dresner was ineffective.
So is it your position that we're supposed to look at the fact that there was a mock trial done and there was a strategy followed, and we're supposed to just say, therefore, he was effective?
I think it is pretty close to that, Your Honor. I mean, the problem we have here is there's no evidence, although Judge Cain may say something to that effect, there's no evidence of deference. Mr. Dresner made a choice, and the fact that it failed seems to be what is driving both the defense argument and the judge's conclusion.
Aren't we supposed to give deference if counsel follows a sound strategy, not just any strategy?
Well, absolutely. It's got to be a sound strategy, but I don't think anybody has ever even evaluated whether this was a sound strategy. There was no discussion by the defense witness about whether this was a sound strategy at all. His position was you had these alternate suspects out there. You had Mr. Dresner choosing to do something different and failing, resulting in the defendant's conviction. Therefore, what you have is per se ineffective assistance. And if that's correct, then any time a defendant is convicted because counsel's strategy failed, they're by definition ineffective.
Doesn't that tie into the Strickland prohibition against analyzing the strategy in hindsight? If the court's finding was primarily based on the fact that it failed, looking backwards, it's a little different than if they look at the strategy going forward and make a determination of reasonableness.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. And at the time that Mr. Dresner made his choice, he had no way of knowing how this would turn out. He couldn't know for sure. And certainly his client had some problems in terms of the defense that he was going to present, just by the way that he dealt with the police and some of the statements he made to them and his association with the victims, his admission that he was there at the time.
But how can counsel effectively evaluate whether or not to present a witness when that witness has not even been interviewed? I mean, that sounds pretty ineffective, and I think that's part of what the trial court was looking at.
Well, obviously, we talked about at the, it was talked about at the 35C hearing that witnesses could have credibility issues, and you can make judgments about someone's credibility actually without interviewing them. And certainly when you look at Kathy Weiss, who was the quote star witness for the defense in this case, she was in jail with Ms. Corkins. She had a criminal history that included theft.
The 35C hearing, did counsel identify credibility issues as a driving force behind their strategy?
It was discussed at the hearing, Your Honor, and certainly when our prosecutor cross-examined Mr. Dresner, she did bring up that this was a consideration. They did not go in great detail to every way that someone could be credible or not credible, but it was discussed, and Certainly, when it was, other witnesses talked about the fact that you can have credibility issues related not just to the way you might perform on the stand, but in reference to who you are and your background and the facts surrounding the way that perhaps your claim came forward, such as in the situation with Ms. Weiss, where all of a sudden after the murders, there she is and she has this great story to tell.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Elizabeth Griffin, registration number 22218, appearing for Mr. Kennedy here today. And I want to start with the ineffective assistance since you spent some time on that. I want to point out, first of all, that the court did not base its conclusion that counsel was incompetent, that his decisions were incompetent, based on the fact that it didn't work. As Judge Fox pointed out, he based it on the fact that he didn't conduct any investigation. And the law tells us that you can't make reasonable strategic decisions if you haven't done the investigation. In this case, both Mr. Dresner and his investigator, Mr. Zook, admitted that they should have interviewed a lot of these witnesses. They were important witnesses, it turned out, but they didn't know that because they didn't interview them. And they didn't watch the videotapes of the witnesses to even observe their demeanor to see how they would have looked. And the person who discussed credibility problems, of course, as I pointed out in my brief, was the trial prosecutor. The trial prosecutor, Mr. Dan Zook, was the one witness who was trying to offer post hoc explanations for what the defense lawyer did, which is a little bit backwards. And he was suggesting that Mr. Dresner didn't want to call these people because they had felony convictions or they had issues with their credibility. Mr. Dresner didn't say that. And Mr. Zook, the prosecutor, of course, called a number of witnesses who had felony convictions and serious felony convictions and credibility problems. So even to the extent that he has any business opining on what Mr. Dresner was thinking, that just doesn't come across as very credible since he called those same kind of witnesses. I really want to talk about the mock trial because I didn't point this out in my brief, and it's very important. There were no decisions made based on this mock trial because the mock trial took place a month before the actual trial, okay? The die was cast, that no investigation was done. The attorney didn't have any direct evidence. What he did, and I have no idea why he chose to put his resources into a mock trial instead of investigating the case, but he put on one case. He didn't put on two cases, one with the direct evidence and one with the hearsay to see which one would do better. The mock trial did not give him feedback that the jury wouldn't have bought the direct evidence because the jury preferred direct evidence. The DA wants to talk about the fact that individual jurors didn't rely on, they didn't say, oh, because we thought this person did it or that person did it. Well, that's because they didn't hear that evidence. I mean, the mock jurors just heard the hearsay. And in addition, some of those mock jurors did indicate in their deliberations and after deliberations that they wondered about the other suspects, wanted to know more about Stroud and Corkins, wanted to know more about that. But the fact that they didn't decide, oh, this person's the one who did the murder, well, how could they? Dresner didn't have that evidence and he didn't give him that evidence. And the other thing about the mock jury that's important to understand is that the analyst told Dresner, look, these results are skewed because you had this investigator playing the DA. He's not a lawyer. And the jurors said, well, we didn't think he seemed very confident in his case. And the jurors said that they were persuaded by the fact that there wasn't hard evidence. And the analyst said, well, you know, you didn't instruct your mock jury that circumstantial evidence weighs the same as direct evidence. And so the real jury's going to know that. The mock jury didn't know that. But no matter what the results were from that mock jury, he had already made his decisions. I mean, he should have gone out and done more investigation at that point, but he didn't. And the truth is, when he got the report from the analyst, he was within less than a month of trial. And so he wasn't doing that. And you don't conduct a mock jury to decide whether to investigate the case.
Let me discuss with you what I was discussing with Mr. Baker, which is the standard of review for us on the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. What are we to make of the trial courts apparently concluding that the presumption of effective assistance was overcome? How are we supposed to deal with that? Well, what is the standard of review?
I'm not certain about what you're saying, the exact question that you're framing. My understanding is that the determination that counsel was below the standard of practice and the determination that there's a reasonable probability that there would have been a different outcome are both subject to de novo review. However, if I'm incorrect, I would welcome you to tell me that. But any factual findings underlying either of those determinations, of course, are subject to clear error review. And the court did make many factual findings about what Mr. Dresner didn't do that he should have done. You know, the court said, just a minute, sorry. The court said that there was evidence available, direct evidence of a conspiracy to kill JC, and that Mr. Dresner didn't try to interview Weiss, McKenna, Weddle, Wyckoff, or other people. He didn't try to get the letters from Stroud to Corkins, and that the evidence was out there if he had done that investigation, that he would have learned about, that Weiss would have testified that Corkins told her this very detailed plan that played out exactly the way the murders happened, about Dudley was going to shoot them in the head in 2 weeks, and he could have gotten proof that Dudley actually visited her on that day in the jail. And McKenna corroborated Weiss because she would have testified that Corkins earlier, when I was in jail with Corkins, she was asking me to get Dudley to come visit her, get Dudley to kill these people, drive Dudley to help him dump the bodies because he doesn't know how to drive. And Weiss and McKenna didn't know each other. They weren't in jail at the same time. So they were extremely corroborating of each other. And the court made really detailed factual findings about what he didn't do and should have done. He didn't interview witnesses, and the court found that you can't make reasonable strategic choices if you don't find out what the evidence is first.
Ms. Griffin, what is your position on the court's ability to consider the FBI letter?
Well, my position is what I said in the brief, which is that I think it's really ambiguous whether that claim was withdrawn. And I think it was the appellant's job to provide you with a record on that. I agree that there wasn't a lot of argument on it. It was pretty briefly mentioned. I disagree wholeheartedly that there was no evidence, because the pleading that they submitted with that was titled Supplemental Materials in Support of Post-Conviction Motion. So it was obviously meant to be materials to support, to be evidentiary support. And that's what the court relied on that letter as. I don't think the letter was seriously disputed. I mean, this was the director of the FBI lab. This wasn't just an employee of the FBI.
Is there any mention of that letter during the 35C proceedings, any discussion about it, or did the reference to it in the court's findings just come sort of out of the blue?
It was referred to very briefly in the defense attorney's closing argument. And that's in my brief. I don't think there was a lot of discussion of it. I agree with that. But I think that since the complete record wasn't provided to you, you do have to presume the correctness of the proceedings, and the court would not have relied on that if the claim weren't before him. I guess I want to briefly talk about the letter, because I think it's important to acknowledge the degree of the misconduct relating to this letter, which doesn't really have to do with the fact that it was reversible. But we never would have found out about this letter if Mr. Stroud didn't happen to have it, and the ADC lawyer went to question him in prison, and he said, oh yeah, I've got this letter, and they used it against me, and the ADC lawyer said, you know, what are you talking about? And it turned out that the DA, the court found that Stroud wrote the letter in 91, that Charles Tate gave it to the DA, that he got 10 years off his sentence for providing this letter against Mr. Stroud, that the DAs had this letter and used it against Mr. Stroud to get him to plead guilty. And it was never turned over to Mr. Kennedy. And when ADC subpoenaed those two cases, the Stroud file and the Tate file, that letter wasn't in there anymore. So we never would have learned of this letter if it weren't for this witness that they happened to talk to who happened to have it.
Griffin, I have a question about the letter. As far as Mr. Kennedy's guilt, the phrase, it's covered, is fairly ambiguous. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, I wouldn't, because Mr. Stroud didn't know Mr. Kennedy. And they had 5 years. They really tried to find some acquaintance or some relationship between Stroud and Corkins and Kennedy, and they didn't.
Right, but it's covered doesn't necessarily say much about whether Stroud hired Kennedy or didn't hire Kennedy or hired someone else. I mean, it sort of implicates Mr. Stroud's involvement, but it doesn't necessarily go to Mr. Kennedy.
Well, I think it does, because for one thing, as I said, they don't know each other, but also the prosecution's theory at this trial was not that Kennedy was hired to do this murder. They had this speculative theory that, oh, he was cheated by his friend Staskowitz, and so he got mad, he wanted his stuff back. They were not saying that he was hired by Stroud. And Kennedy didn't come into money. There was no evidence that he was a contract killer. He wasn't a biker. Stroud's letter, you know, referred to bikers who were taken care of.
Okay, so I guess you're saying it's covered meant that Stroud hired someone else and not Kennedy, or got persuaded someone else and not Kennedy to hire to commit the killing.
That's certainly what it looks like. I mean, he was in prison at the time, right. So.
And Mr. Stroud testified at the 35C hearing that's what it meant.
Yes.
Okay, well, I guess my question goes, as far as a Brady violation, how is the prosecutor supposed to know what it's covered meant before Mr. Stroud testifies at the 35C hearing?
Well, you know, I don't think there's any question that everything is covered, and I've took care of the dad with the VP of the Hells Angels, so that's covered too. And if you don't lie and tell my story, I'm going to kill your son. I mean, I think it's very clear that he's implicating himself in the murders. And if he is implicating himself in these murders, that is exculpatory and highly material evidence. And I don't remember the U.S. Supreme Court case, maybe Kyles v. Whitley, but one of them says that if there's a question and the DA is not sure, they need to turn it over. And I don't think there's even a question about this.
I guess one final question,
yeah,
because we're running out of time. If we were to uphold the trial court's granting of the 35C motion on any one of the three grounds that you've raised, is there any necessity to reach the other two?
Well, the only necessity, not a necessity, but if then the Supreme Court were to take cert, then they would have to send it back. But other than that, no, I don't think so. I mean, I think the court could have granted a new trial on any of these grounds, and so that would be sufficient. On the DNA evidence, I just really want to point out the fact that this was really exculpatory because, first of all, the defense experts, Mr. Arndt, who was running the CBI lab, said, Mr. Eichelenboom, he runs a good lab. I endorse him. I endorse his testing. Barry Goetz was the other expert, and he was a CBI agent for 20 years and ran the Pueblo lab. These guys know what they're doing. They looked at all of the police reports, all the testimony. They looked at Detective Finley's reenactment of the crimes. They looked at the expert testimony about what the physical evidence showed, and they made their own assessments. And they tested very specific places, such as Mr. Staskowitz's pant cuffs, around his pant cuffs, his boots, because everybody agreed that the killer dragged his body across the room by his ankles. And so the fact that they tested several things around his ankles and there was foreign DNA and Mr. Kennedy was excluded as a donor is highly exculpatory material. And the same goes for the sponge pieces, because everybody agreed that those sponge pieces were from a silencer and that the killer would have stuffed them into something. And so the fact that there was foreign DNA and Kennedy was excluded, highly exculpatory. They tested over 80 samples and they found foreign DNA on almost everything. And the only thing that was Kennedy's was a cigarette butt that was on the coffee table in a can or something. And that wasn't connected to the killer. I mean, he had been at their house, so it wasn't surprising that his DNA would be on a cigarette butt. But also in the DA's brief, they complained that we didn't prove whose DNA it was. And I want to remind you that we wanted samples from Mr. Dudley, Mr. Glimp, who was Dudley's alibi and the guy who may have driven him over, and Mr. Blunk, who was sitting with the bodies the next day. And they wouldn't provide samples, and the DA would not help us get those samples. And so that is the reason we weren't able to compare them. I thank you, and I ask you to affirm.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your fine arguments. The case is deemed submitted, and you may expect a written opinion in due course.